divine standards for treatment of others. I think growth for me involved not tossing the cultural stuff out carelessly, not tossing out all of it, certainly, just not buying it as a complete package anymore. Opening the package and having a look at exactly what was in it and what wasn't and why. Being open to the very real possibility that every little bit of it needed to work and be good, or those non-working little bits might need to go. God held me, not my culture, responsible for what kind of life I lived and how I treated others, so I couldn't blame my culture for my own inability to act better than I did. If I met a guy playing music in a bar, and he was a good guy, if my brethren conscience told me that I ought to preach at him, or feel better than him because I was a Christian, or that it was okay to act as if his unchristian ideas and lifestyle were entirely without merit, then that needed work. I needed to be more like Jesus. I needed to be able to connect, not just correct. I needed to be able to disagree in an open way instead of closing off and walking away. Christianity needed to inspire me to connect in new ways to all kinds of other human beings, that's a love thing, instead of providing an excuse for me to not even try to connect, and that's not. In fact, my experience with artists and musicians and good old boys hanging out casually in quiet little village pubs showed me that my conscience needed to step it up a notch in terms of run-of-the-mill human things like openness, honesty, humility, decency, candor, integrity, warmth, and compassion. If I was to attain the standards of, say, those in a bar, that is. So there had to be no more claiming my standards and practices were better just because they were allegedly Christian, when clearly they sucked. My church culture, locally anyway, definitely had lower standards for these social human things than I saw in other local communities that were not claiming to be Christian. Melody writes,
"Even today, when our church members get together, they tend to speak very negatively about certain groups of people, gays in particular. I always want to ask, what if you had the chance to tell a gay man about your relationship with Jesus? Would you say those things to the gay man's face? It's disgusting. They also like to tell racist jokes and bluster about how we need to kill all the radical Islamists, which they say all Muslims are."
In dealing with worldly folk with higher standards as to social decency and kindness, what I found was that higher standards can rub off on one. So I tried to make that happen. Tried to learn the virtues of the more socially adept worldlies by example, and I was prayerful about it, and despite my upbringing, maybe even a bit humble. I know I'm not the only one who found it a giant, joyful, freeing revelation to stop seeing the people in the world as all messed up by sin and allied with evil in ways that we supposedly weren't. Once I learned to look past the tattoos, swearing, dirty jokes, smoking, alcohol, and cards of the rank unbelievers, I started to see real people, just like me, only with more life experiences and observations than I'd had time to put together. Carol reports something similar as to meeting others outside the one right place and finding good in them and trying to be good to them.
"The dawning of that reality was one of the reasons that allowed me to leave. So freeing, humbling, and exciting an idea to come to grips with about the outside world. Jesus might actually be out there instead of only in here."
In my teens, I'd felt like the only real interaction I should properly be having with worldly people was to try to get them to come out to meeting. It was something to meet them in their own natural habitat, being themselves, rather than to have them meet me in mine, not being me. Not knowing who I was, but hiding it from Christians anyway. I feel like my conscience was, and is, always being tuned up. To begin with, I found that God was perhaps less concerned about my going to the movies than he was about my being solitary, cold, pious, and nasty at meeting and elsewhere. And I found that dutifully abstaining from all of that church-condemned stuff was a fleshly human effort, which therefore fed the closed, prideful flesh. That piety was making me demonstrate more of the works of the flesh, rather than less. Legalism, I came to realize, made me feel entitled to be arrogant and closed and cold, made me dismissive of more and more people, Christians included, made me feel entitled to unthinkingly correct anyone and anything all day long, and not do much else. Made me selfish and want to protect my reputation for top-notch piety. Made me want to project, advertise, and perpetuate that reputation above all things. Made me less than useless to other people. Manifestly unhelpful. Made me status-focused. Made me a disciple of the Pharisees like Saul of Tarsus, and not a disciple of Jesus at all. Louisa says the same thing about herself.
When I left the meeting followed me as it was inside of me. The sins of the meeting are my own sins. I left with a PhD in judgmentalism.
People still often tell me, it's so sad that I haven't moved on from worrying about the flaws of others. What really keeps me navel-gazing and self-judging is a daily awareness of my all-too-present flaws and where they're coming from. It's an undeniable fact that my formative years formed me. No matter how much I know I really hated how people treated me back then, I have absolutely been formed into a person who will sometimes unthinkingly act just the same way to others. We are caca cookies cut out with the same cookie cutter, many of us. So I want to lose the blinkered Pharisee conscience and develop a capacity to recognize the Pharisee attitude and spirit showing itself in my heart and in my day and judge it, see it clearly for what it is, smell it in my interactions, look to God for something better. The fleshly church efforts come from a very deep place in there. It all appeals to the flesh, to everything human and flawed in me, to the part of me that's afraid Christ doesn't or won't bother to really work, to the part of me that needs to grab the wheel. That Pharisee-trained conscience and those ancient human ideas about repeatedly vowing renewed acts of piety were actually what we Christians were using to try to be more Christian. Ironic. Time for an upgrade. Time to let Christ into things. Upgrade. Today I can see how much my conscience has to smarten up a bit about all that fleshly stuff. It really has blind spots, mostly about how to treat people. Seeing as normal what were in retrospect pretty horrible things that I saw all the time growing up. Blind spots as to our ability to love like Christians. Blind spots we justified because of our supposed focus on scriptural light instead. Correctness, doctrine. But a rush of guilt or shame doesn't make one act better or even do much of a job of keeping one from acting badly. What needs to happen is one needs to learn to see more, to see higher, broader, and more deeply, to see both what's not working and not good, and also what would work and be better. And we have an easier time doing this when we see it going on around us. We learn best by example and by doing. We learn worst by being shamed and resolving to do better without really knowing how, without seeing anyone else knowing either. I'd learned about as much as I was going to socially from people in my own brethren culture. And I found I had an awful lot to learn when I tried to be a good friend to people who weren't brethren, people who wanted and needed me. It was hard at first, and most of my brethren friends were little help, too busy being brethren to talk to someone who ate with publicans and sinners, or even open brethren. Others of my brethren friends, by contrast, became shrill, ham-fisted caricatures of worldly, unchurched hedonism, going into bars and acting how they thought people in bars acted, but getting it all very wrong, standing out, being jerks, not realizing that everywhere, there are protocols, and just throwing away your own cultural protocols doesn't mean you're now ready to move smoothly in, say, the culture of a rock band, a blind date, a committee, an art exhibition, or something like that, or even a pub in a small town. No matter the setting, there are always conventions to help people connect, and just claiming to have better standards doesn't make you able to connect and excuse you from meeting people where they are and talking to them more or less how they'll put up with being spoken to. I can't tell you how many brethren people had had enough and left our group to seek out a more conventional church only to act as brethren as one could imagine in that church, starting to control freak and shame and taint everyone and everything in there. They'd hated people Phariseeing them at meeting, but first chance they got, they put that hat on themselves and never took it off again. We need help to stop acting legalistic. to stop needing to correct and control everything around us. We need examples of how Christians can be more like Christ and less like Pharisees. We need time to work it all out. We need the patience and forbearance of others. But we had so much shame and so many rules that many of us really did just toss the rules and think we were good to go. Without learning much of anything, we had so much to learn. We still do. Following my own will? I had a very hard time, especially at first, with the idea of going out and getting good stuff for myself and mine. We Plymouth Brethren lived a pretty weird life, most would say. Our church culture was full of contradictions and control and numerous odd sacrifices, and so in most ways we were all extremely passive. In fact, many of us helped enforce passivity as the only way of life that we really accepted as normal in our group. We lived quite oddly. And why were we living this way, did we say? We passively said we were passively just seeking to do the Lord's will. That's what we said we were doing, and why we said we were doing it. It was, as I've said before, presented as a clear dichotomy. You could either actively do your own will, or you could passively do little and call that the Lord's will. The Lord's will always and only involved not doing yours, and it always involves sacrifice. John Nelson Darby, a man who didn't like how the Anglican Church did things any more than he liked short, simple sentences, so broke away from that church while recovering from hitting his head on a door jamb while falling off a horse while dutifully making his rounds as an Anglican curate, and in thus doing became the de facto leader worldwide of what became known as the Brethren Movement, running everything precisely how he saw fit, causing the First Brethren Division when a man named Newton disagreed with him as to doctrine, wrote,
"Liberty of will is just slavery to the devil."
Darby wrote this about a century before George Orwell ironically used the phrase "freedom is slavery" in the book 1984, along with 2 plus 2 equals 5. I'd always been taught that no matter how spiritual you became, no matter how infused with God as Father, Son, and Holy Bible you became, you'd never want to do what he wanted you to. Not really. No, you'd want to do your own will, which was evil continually, not redeemable. So, you just learn to say no to your heart's desires, and to claim that as to most of what you and your church did, well, you are merely obeying God in so doing. People who shun me to this day tell me they don't want to do it, but need to obey the Lord and bow to assembly decisions. Not their whims, but whims be done. Kind of an anti-growth theology. I think it involved the idea that God didn't really make us better. He simply stopped planning on sending us to hell. And then, when we went to heaven, he'd cut out of us our capacity to want things, along with our tear ducts, and those problems would be over. Kind of like being lobotomized. While your average non-church kid was being asked, "What do you want to do with your life?" or "Which one do you want?" we were being taught never to think like that and to seek what God wanted instead. It was supposed to be that simple, like he was going to let us kids know in advance, like all we had to do was follow the script he'd promised to give us, the map of our future. It was a map of Africa. So those of us trying to leave behind our Brethren culture a bit had to learn to start to trust God with our hopes and dreams. Nowadays, Ruth is learning to trust him with her own actual hopes and dreams, to, as the scripture puts it, give her the desires of her heart. She says,
"I trust God with one dream, hope, and aspiration at a time. I double dare him to take care of them for me, to guide me in regard to them, and to bring them to fruition. So far, he has answered so many prayers, made so many dreams come true, shattered only the hopes that in retrospect would not have been the best thing for me, and guided me in so many almost tangible ways that I feel quite foolish to not trust him with stuff. I have come a long way since my teens, when I was sure I was a bad Christian because I did not feel called to darkest Africa. I felt validated when I read Jane Eyre as a young girl, the part regarding her decision whether or not to serve as a missionary in India. Now I believe that God has plenty of work for ordinary people right at home, and that work doesn't always look like passing out gospel tracts, witnessing to every stranger you meet, and preaching on the street corner."
I've already mentioned Bill's comment about how Christians do whatever they want and then say God told them to do it. Well, many lived like this. Others really convinced themselves that whatever they did, if it worked out well, must have been the Lord's will, as he'd blessed them in it, if it hadn't gone horribly awry. After all, if it hadn't been his will, but ours instead, he'd have cursed it, right? It was pretty simple in theory. So I frequently refused to act until God let me know what he wanted. I would resolve to wait until he made his heart known, and only then would I act. God would make all of my life decisions for me. I didn't need to worry about that. Everyone agreed this was absolutely the thing to do. I agreed that it was too. Thing is, he'd never agreed to work like that himself. And he made it pretty clear to me that he flat out refused to work that way with me. To begin with, it tortured me. I was paralyzed and afraid to act, afraid to decide or choose anything. How could I learn the Lord's will so I could just do it in simple obedience to it? In the Bible, people heard a voice. This would have terrified me, but I kind of wanted it too. You see, I didn't want the pressure of having to figure things out, know my own heart, use what wisdom I had, ask God for more wisdom, make a decision based on the best information I had, using the best judgment I had, and then live with the consequences even if I'd made a mistake. Turns out, God expected me to do just that, exactly like that. God wasn't exactly the divine watchmaker, but there was an instructive story laid out for me in the Bible which seemed to apply more to my life than a voice from heaven telling me what kind of wood, shittim, and how many cubits, 10 times 30 in a span. The story, told in the Gospels in a couple of different versions, for instance in Matthew 25 verses 14 through 29, involves a nobleman who gives his three servants money, the KJV calls the unit of currency talents, for them to invest. Each servant gets a different number of talents, perhaps because of their differing levels of financial expertise, and the nobleman leaves them to do as they see fit. He goes away on a journey for a long time. When he comes back, he wants to see how they've done in his absence, following their best judgment. He'd already shown he knew who had the best judgment of the three, but he'd still given the one clueless guy a talent to invest so he could learn. The first two each managed to double the investment and gave all the money to the nobleman when he got back. In return, he put them in positions of greater responsibility and importance and invited them to enter into his joy. But the third servant had a different situation. He knew that the nobleman expected results. He was afraid. So he dug a hole, hid the money, and then dug it up and gave it back to him upon his return, having lost not a coin of it. The nobleman was furious, told him off for not even bothering to keep it safe in a bank where it would have collected interest, and took the money from him and gave it to the higher earner of the other two, and then had the man who'd not used his talent duly cast into outer darkness. A cautious, non-committal path was not okay with this boss. Now, if I was honest, I realized that I'd been given potential, life, a mind, talents, and was going to try to refuse to develop, let alone follow, sound judgment. I just wanted to simply obey, not take risks, not get into trouble. And really important decisions were hard. Often, it turned out, they were hard because there was merit in deciding either way. When there was a decision to be made, and one way was likely to work out, and the other one not, I called those easy decisions. Hard ones were different. Even decisions like, should I get a Radio Shack TRS-80 color computer 2, a Coleco Atom, an Apple IIe, or a Commodore 64, didn't seem to be ones that God was going to help with, though they mattered very much to me. He actually really seemed to expect me to learn all I could, talk to some people, figure things out, follow the best judgment I had, and then be willing to live with the results. Even if I made a poor decision, he seemed very okay with all that, particularly with unfortunate decisions. Helped me out after things had gone wrong far more than he had when I was trying to make decisions to begin with. He seemed to insist upon the training wheels coming off and my taking steps without holding on to him. He wanted to be right beside me, but not be used as a crutch, nor as heroin. Not that I made enough poor decisions to really enjoy how much God enjoys helping us make lemonade of our lemons. Mostly, I avoided decisions if I could, by doing the same thing, the same way, every time. avoiding change, avoiding responsibility, maintaining deniability, and a non-committal stance. This approach consistently annoyed, and still annoys him, if I do it, I think. One of the first times I met my friend Mark, I asked him how exactly he thought one found the Lord's will so one could do it and be in it and live it. Mark just tossed out, "I don't believe in the Lord's will," back over his shoulder while going into a narrow stairwell to climb down a few floors without using the stairs by pressing hands and feet out against the side walls and generally being Spider-Man. Mark often speaks for effect and to make you think, rather than to express the entire complexity of an opinion of his. And this made me think, all right. How workable was the idea of waiting to know the Lord's will before acting? Did the Lord expect us to make decisions using our best judgment? There were verses one could quote to argue either side of that one, certainly. But something about how the old folks were presenting the Lord's will concept seemed a bit off. They connected it to the idea that God has a plan for us, a path, which we needed to let him guide us along every step of the way, like my GPS plotting a route to Boston. These are, I believe, called sat-navs in Europe, a thing that uses satellites to make you not need to learn how to fold a roadmap. My GPS is pretty good. Besides depicting my car on screen as the General Lee from the Dukes of Hazzard or the Batmobile, a Dalek, the TARDIS, or an X-Wing, depending on my mood, and speaking in a female voice with a British accent, it has another cool feature. If I make a mistake while driving, it figures out, on the fly, how to adjust the route so I still end up in Boston, without needing to drive all the way back to the place where I first messed up once I am totally lost. It just figures out where I've gotten to, and how to still get where I'm heading, though the journey is now different in terms of what are now appropriate turns, and perhaps in terms of expected time frame as well. The planned path changes to correct for my errors. It seems to me that in some people's minds, God wasn't as smart, or as helpful anyway, as my GPS is. I asked, and was repeatedly told, that should I get things wrong one time in following the Lord's carefully laid out plan for me, that I would certainly have to return back to the beginning and start all over again, repenting in dust and ashes. But there are many Bible stories that kind of make the point that once you mess up, there's no going back. No mulligans. Well, to be honest, mostly they present the idea that once people mess up properly, they are just screwed. That's it for many of them. Esau, Cain, Saul, Ananias, and Sapphira. And in my own experience, things don't really work that way in my dealings with life and God. The whole "you need to go back and start all over again" thing. Some things you go through are going to last, will be things that aren't going to be undone. House burned down, ruined relationship, totaled cars, criminal record, addiction, adultery, injury to others, pregnancy. No undoing those. And in reality, the God I tend to encounter while I'm living my life seems more than comfortable rolling with those choices, whatever they are. The game seems to be to try. A lot gets worked out on the fly. Obeying sounds good. So why not obey God when he clearly wants me to develop and follow sound judgment based on experience, listening to others, and looking to honor him given what's in the Bible? Why try to refuse to do that? Why bury potential in the ground and wait for him to come back so we can hand him our talent, our life, our time, pretty much unused but a bit gritty and damp just because he wouldn't give us stone tablets or the address and phone number of the girl, job, or house? Why not do what he wants us to, which is figure some of it out on our own? Professionals call this stumbling through and fumbling through. They see it as necessary to the process of getting through at all. When I was getting my master's degree so I could be a teacher, one stony-faced professor made us read her favorite book, and then discussed it endlessly in a quiet, unbroken monotone. It was The Reflective Practitioner by Donald Shern. One point which she hammered home repeatedly was that no matter the discipline or profession, no matter how educated and prepared a professional is, one thing they all still have to do on pretty much a daily basis is work things out on the fly. This is certainly a part of teaching. It is definitely a part of life. Things aren't almost ever going to be as we expect, even if God had spoken to us about it all in an actual voice beforehand. we still find ourselves thrown for a loop and needing to work out what to do because things aren't usually what we thought at all. In my experience, God seems to make sure of this. In my life anyway, He wasn't content with me simply obeying. He wanted initiative, creativity, and inspiration. About our trained passivity, Anne writes,
I feel like this is a really big, important topic. It's about not engaging with life in a way. I truly have great regret over the many experiences I longed for and didn't have, even if they might have been mistakes. You can move on much faster if you try something and find out it doesn't work, rather than just longing for it disguised as praying about it. I think it's a crime that I just spent years of my life hoping for my life to begin at some point, but waiting for some sort of external permission to get started.
It took me most of the way through my 20s to even start living my own life for God. When it came down to it, I wasn't apt to disobey, should I feel there was a clear scriptural principle or something I'd learned to expect from Him personally in my dealings with Him. But I didn't want to have to make my own decisions either, for fear of screwing up. I was quite troubled when it turned out that God flat out refused to make my life decisions for me. He wanted me to show some passion, some initiative, some resourcefulness and commitment, some courage even. He wanted me to take some accountability for being actively successful. He was like my dad letting go when I was learning how to walk, ride a bike, or swim. God does let go so we can learn and grow, and He does let us fall. I've skinned me a knee or two. The life that God gives has blood and pain and hurt feelings in it, and He refuses to fix that. But I was raised to fear more than anything else getting caught messing up by church people, by my parents as representatives of that culture. I feared my church more than anything, but did not really fear God, certainly not as much, and not as a separate person from it. That has changed. Now I fear God and do not fear my birth culture. I don't just fear screwing up and God knowing. I feel how out of control and unaware I am of so many things. God is in the blackness and cold of deep space. He is in the unimaginable heat at the heart of the sun. He is gravity and molecules and light and sound. Have you ever lay on your back and looked up at the night sky and suddenly it didn't look like a pretty canopy stretched overhead anymore? Suddenly it was something so huge you wanted to think of it as a pretty canopy to even deal with it? Have you ever felt like you could fall into the vastness of it and tumble screaming forever? Have you ever felt how beyond you birth and death really are? Felt yourself aging? Felt yourself healing from injury? Felt how much of that simply isn't you and isn't anything you can even influence much? Got a glimpse of how ancient everything but you is? Suddenly God's not in His box anymore. He's not in His room. He's not just inside the Bible. He's the source of everything we are part of everything else, of things we can't imagine, and of us too. When you encounter God, really God, no one has to quote verses at you and scold you to always remember to fear the Lord. You know fear. It's almost all you can know. Things aren't adequately explained by your church or textbook. You need to never forget His scope, yet figure out that He loves you, is creating good, and has more grace and mercy than anyone else ever. And you will need and be shattered over and over again by that grace until it becomes as mundane and reliable as gravity.